Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, no wine, no beer, no spirits. You're under the weather and there's snow.
Right, and so I am going to try and stay hydrated with my bottle of water tonight.
I'm not going to complain about the cold because I know the rest of the country, you know, the Midwest, are minus 20, minus 10. And I think the lowest we got this week was 8. It was cold.
It was colder with the wind, too.
People had it worse.
That's true. People did have it worse.
Not yet. Now, you people down in Florida, I don't even want to talk
about
it.
That's right.
We split this week. We're only going to talk about three films. I saw all three. You saw two, I believe. You did. You were a little too sick to come out to the first film we're going to talk about. And this week's widest release. And it shows you kind of what a down week it is. That the widest release this week is Miss Bala. Miss Bala, starring Gina Rodriguez. I don't know if you know Gina Rodriguez as Jane the Virgin.
Mm-hmm.
I've been watching her recently. She's the voice of Carmen Sandiego on Netflix, which me and my son have been watching pretty good. But she is now Miss Bala. And actually, I don't even know what that means, Miss Bala. But
Isn't that the same name as the original Mexican film that this is an American remake of?
It is a remake of a 2011 Mexican film.
Called Miss Bala.
Yeah, with an all-Mexican cast shot in Mexico. And this is my first, before I even describe the plot or whatever, my first gripe is that they're talking about how this is barrier-breaking. Now new audiences can identify and empathize and connect with an action hero that looks like them. I'm like, wait a minute. They took a Mexican film and Americanized it with an American
right.
director and an American actress, and that's barrier-breaking? Wasn't the first one barrier breaking?
Yeah, well, we've been seeing an awful lot of these remakes lately, so that's also an interesting little sideline to talk about. Is just, I mean, we had The Upside, and next week we'll be talking about Cold Pursuit with Liam Neeson. And so it's like, what is with remaking what is basically a decent foreign film into a mediocre American version? I don't know if it's really worthwhile.
And mediocre is pretty generous. Brought to you by director Catherine Hardwicke. You know her.
Twilight.
From the first installment of Twilight. Also another film about identity. Because a lot of things about Miss Bala is identity. And we'll get to about why that is. So first of all, Gina Rodriguez as Gloria Fuentes is an undervalued, underappreciated makeup artist. It's time for a vacation. Her first scene just doesn't go very well. She needs to get out of town. So she goes south of the border to Tijuana to hang out with Suzu, her old and bestest friend. And you know bad things are coming because they exchange friendship bracelets and they say, you know, you're more like family than a friend. So they go to a party, the kickoff party for Miss Baja California. A gang of ne'er-do-wells with assault rifles interrupt the party, shoot a lot of people, and at the end, Gloria cannot find Suzu. Suzu's missing. Is she dead? I don't know. Is she kidnapped? Where did she go? That's the central conflict arc of the movie. Gloria must find Suzu. And before she can really even get started, she's delivered to the head of Los Estrellas, Lino. He is the head of the gang that stormed the nightclub, and he's going to use Gloria to his advantage. He's like, you know what? I will help you. I will help you find Suzu. I have ways. But for me, you are going to transport a whole bunch of cocaine and cash over the border to San Diego. You're going to deliver this car bomb. I'm also going to teach you how to use an assault rifle and treat you as my girlfriend. And hopefully feed you some nice barbecue and maybe some Stockholm Syndrome will set in. And you'll like this lifestyle.
Well, and where's the whole beauty pageant come in? Because I kept saying things that look like that this was some sort of like twisted, dark miscongeniality going on here.
So to ultimately find Suzu, this film that some people say, especially the director say, is about female empowerment and female self-discovery and discovering the inner action hero inside of you, she must win the beauty pageant to find Suzu. So it does. There is some miscongeniality there. She must go and wear these fancy gowns and smile and do that wave. And anything about empowerment and self-discovery flies out the window in just a flail of hypocrisy when that happens. So then they can set up the shot, the iconic shot of Gina Rodriguez wearing this really high-cut red dress with an assault rifle and a pissed-off look on her face.
Yes.
Miss Bala is terrible. It's a terrible film. Back to the identity. Lino is saying, Gloria, you and I are the same. We both grew up on opposite sides of the border, right there in Southern California and Northern Mexico. I am too Mexican to be gringo. I am too gringo to be Mexican. That is why I take what is mine. And I want to argue with him because a lot of things that he takes is not his, including Gloria. And so that's what they're talking about, identity. And that's what reminded me of Twilight. To love the vampire or to love the werewolf.
Well, Catherine Hardwicke's, that first Twilight was probably the weakest of the series in terms of the direction. But it was also the first one out of the gate. And she was not back, I don't think, for any of the others. But what struck me about this film that I did not see, one is that you were like, oh, you should have been here, because then you could have.
There's a chance you would have liked it more than me, because he was like, oh, well, I identified with that. And actually, the theme about identity did work, and you're overemphasizing the beauty pageant.
Yeah,
you could be fighting with me right now.
I could be fighting with you, except that then I saw that it has a 30% on Rotten Tomatoes. So obviously, most people of any either gender are not particularly caring for this movie. And the other thing is that it was rated, I noticed this when I was reading up on it before I realized I could not go, was that it was rated PG-13, but I thought the funniest thing was that it said PG-13, quote, for sequences of gun violence, sexual and drug content, thematic material, and language. I'm like, what the heck is an R? If that's PG-13?
I'm very shocked this is actually PG-13. Someone takes a bullet to the skull. I mean, it's just off screen, but it happens. There's a lot of gun violence and grenade launchers and people getting exploded. I'm surprised this is PG-13.
That just seems very odd to me. So I don't think this is one that I'm going to be rushing out to catch up on.
One point in his favor, it is obviously actually filmed in Tijuana. So good on him for going down there for the realism. I mean, it is.
Gritty?
I didn't think, you know, and this is me maybe stereotyping from the news. I imagine Tijuana as being run by cartels and having just vacant lots and buildings and just nastiness.
Have you never been to Tijuana?
No.
Oh, I crossed over to Tijuana when I lived in L.A.
But
went San Diego to Tijuana.
Apparently, it's a new recent culinary capital of Mexico. The top four restaurants in Mexico are all in Tijuana, and I did not know this is a very famous bullring there, sports stadium bullring, and there's a shootout in the parking lot that takes place there, and it's very iconic. I think if you're familiar with that town, and me not even being familiar with that town, is like, oh, I can tell this is a landmark that people will know. So good on Catherine Hardwicke for going realism there.
Yeah, but again, then why not just stick with the 2011 Mexico version?
Absolutely, there was no need to Americanize this movie and call it barrier breaking, because it's not. It's actually,
it's a retread.
It's not whitewashing, but it's Americanizing. It's Westernizing. It's Northern Hemisphereizing. Call it what you will. It's a bastardization of an original film. I guarantee you, I have not seen.
Yeah, I didn't.
But
see it.
Is better.
And I wouldn't be surprised. Same as how I felt about The Upside a few weeks ago. The Upside I actually liked, but I did not like it nearly as much as the original. And I would still just tell most people that that the French movie that it was based on would be the preferable one to see because it's so good. And so, you know, with this one, I'm just not sure where, you know, why they're just sort of dragging out these decent foreign films and Americanizing them. I just don't think it's necessary, and there's got to be enough original material out there that deserves to get seen.
And Anthony Mackie shows up. Falcon from the Avengers shows up in a very bit role, and he's a little overacting in it, and this character does not add up at all. And I'm shocked that they got Anthony Mackie to show up in this. I'm very surprised.
Yeah.
And he's really, other than Gina Rodriguez, is the only other name I recognized.
Okay.
Our next film is, you can go watch, this is one of those, you can go watch it right now, folks. It's on Netflix as of today, and it's called Velvet Buzzsaw. And I just love the title because it's so weird. Oxymoronic when you think about it. Brought to you by Dan Gilroy. You know the name because he brought back most of the cast from Nightcrawler. Nightcrawler was his first film. In 2014, he was nominated for Best Original Screenplay for Nightcrawler. And that was one of those, not a cult hit, not necessarily underground, but one of those out-of-nowhere films that really knocked some people for a loop. Dan Gilroy then went on to make Roman J. Israel Esquire. Now he's back with his third film, Velvet Buzzsaw, with Jake Gyllenhaal, again. Wife Renee Russo,
again,
and others. What was your, because I think I made you watch this, or did you watch Velvet Buzzsaw?
Yeah, I did. I watched it.
What was your initial gut reaction to the critique of the contemporary art world?
Well, it's one of those films that I figured was more up your alley because it's purposely pretentious from start to finish. I was one of those ones who was sort of pleasantly surprised by Nightcrawler. But that's because Jake Gyllenhaal just always has, he is the actor's actor. He makes sure that he really inhabits his characters. And so this role was written for Jake Gyllenhaal. And so he takes it on full steam. But it is it's a bizarre movie about art, you know, commodity of the art world versus art for art's sake, and art comes alive and kills people. I mean, I don't even know how you would exactly describe it, but it's creepy, and it's like a horror satire.
It is.
And
it's a satirical horror film.
Yeah, and so that's not a genre that I particularly like. I stuck with it, but it's an odd flick.
I found this to be a bookend piece. We saw a documentary last year. It was at AFI Docs, but we didn't see it till later, called The Price of Everything. And it's a documentary about the obscene prices in the modern art world. And it, you know, we follow a couple artists, some dealers, some peculiar buyers, and you really get into this world going, wow, this is some weird stuff going on. This is the fictionalized version of that. Jake Gyllenhaal plays, and this is a juicy name, Morf Vandewalt, and he plays a critic. And I like to watch how people put critics on screen. They do it very well here. He is a very uppity, pretentious, self-important critic, but people pay attention to him. If he likes it, it will sell for millions of dollars. If he does not like it, he will torpedo the sale, and the artist will probably no longer be an artist. That's how important Morf Vandewalt is. The other main, this is an ensemble film. There are six leads, but the other main lead is Renee Russo. She is the number one Los Angeles art dealer,
Rhodora Hayes. I love that name too.
Yeah, Rhodora Hayes. She just has a knack for knowing what Morf will and will not like. So she's very successful buying and selling for her clients. And so what I loved about Velvet Buzzsaw is the art never has a say. You know, it's bought, it's sold, it's, you know, commodified. And now art is saying, I have a say too, and I'm going to start killing people. a lady who works for Rhodora, Josefina, lives in an apartment building. And her next door neighbor, an elderly gentleman, just dies. He up and dies one day. And his final wish was that all the artwork in his apartment be burned. Be destroyed, and he was already well into destroying it. Josefina says, I smell an opportunity here. So she spirits, steals all the artwork in the man's apartment into hers, and she and Rhodora hatch a plan to create a mystique around the man, this unknown genius now who's become known in death, and they start selling the artwork. And the artwork has some really bad vibes with it. There's some bad backstory to that artwork. And anyone involved with maybe making a profit off the artwork or moving it around is probably going to have a bad time. There are some artists portrayed in the film by John Malkovich and David Diggs. They look at the art a little different. They sit down and stare at it. They see something within the art. It's like, it's so real, it's almost moving. And they look at it enough to know they should probably be wary of the art. Toni Collette,
oh right,
shows up. She was a museum director, a curator, who decided it was time for her to cash in, and she became an art advisor to some art collector billionaire. And she has an interesting moment with something called the Sphere. Another art dealer John Don Don, played by Tom Sturridge, shows up. So at times, Dan Gilroy is mocking. He's mocking the art world. Uh-huh. John Don Don, Morph Van de Waals.
Yeah.
And I love, though, that he gives the artwork a say. I love everything about that.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a trippy film. And, you know, the artist's name, I think it was like Dees. And I was like, are they trying to do a play on deceased? You know, that's what I was.
Vitrell Dees.
Dees.
And, it moved. I don't know if you noticed this. The first 10 minutes, it's at a convention center, and all the characters are there, and all the beginnings of the storyline are there. I was so lost for the first 10 minutes trying to remember who was who knows whom, who has a problem
who
with what.
Who works for who.
And, you know, whose motivations is what. It's Aaron Sorkin tripled is how fast it was moving.
Yeah, I mean, the dialogue was very sharp and witty in the first half. You know, really weaving a lot of humor and horror into this whole notion of just basically how they peddle perception. And I think that's what the Redora character says at one point, that that's her job, is they peddle perception. And the idea that money can destroy art. And it's just... you know, it's got some clever bits, but at the same time, it sort of moves midway through into your more, what I think is just your more conventional horror movie. And you just know that things are not going to end well for a lot of people. And when you see like a piece of functional art that has like people put their arms into this piece of art, I'm like, that's not going to end well for somebody, you know, when you've got this thing like, let's just interact with this piece of art. Well, anybody who interacts with any art in this film basically will end up bloodied or dead. So if you're okay with that, and if you like that kind of mashup of sharp satire and horror and a little bit of humor, then, you know, this is a good one to just sort of see at home on Netflix. I don't think you really need to see it in the theater. I think it's found its place.
There is some gore in the film. There's some buckets of blood, but I think that's really just beside the point. That you're right, that's mostly the second half of the film. The first half of Velvet Buzzsaw is a lot stronger. You're developing characters, you're creating the story arcs, you're diving deeper into the art world, and the second half is kind of just mopping it up. Kind of, you're whittling down the characters now from the six leads to five to four to three, and that's just, you know, that's just plot. That's just, yeah, I heard there was blood in this movie, so here's the blood. It's really beside the point. Velvet Buzzsaw's not about it. It is more satire than it is horror. It has things to say. It's not the most profound thing I've ever seen, but it's memorable.
Yeah, it is memorable, and it's, you know, it creates these characters that you sort of love to hate. You don't really like any of these people, and but you kind of stick with them anyway. And I would say that the Jake Gyllenhaal character is the one that you kind of think, and you know, maybe is realizing the morality play going on here, and starts to recognize, you know, that maybe his critiques and his business and the way things have started to turn in the art world, you know, maybe he's developing a little bit of a conscience where that's concerned, but doesn't necessarily save anyone in this film. So I mean, it's creepy, it's weird.
Yeah, I like creepy and weird.
I know. So, you know, if you like creepy, weird satire, then this is perfect.
Speaking of characters you don't like and loathsome characters on screen that you have to follow, you made me watch a movie this week called Untogether. And so tell me, first of all, I think I know why you wanted to watch it, Jamie Dornan.
Wait, did you watch it?
I did.
Okay.
I did watch it.
I thought you would actually kind of like it.
So before I offer my opinion, tell us a little bit. What's going on with the direct-to-video film called Untogether?
Well, it does have, as you mentioned, Jamie Dornan, and he's playing this author who is a doctor who has written some best-selling book about based on some woman he saved in war, you know, when he was working in Gaza. And so he's... you know, he's like this sort of playboy, well-to-do dude. And he meets this this woman, Andrea, who is this sort of recently sober, recovering addict writer whose career has stalled. And they strike up this weird romance. And it's a romantic dramedy, but way artier. So it's not like your conventional romantic drama. I consider it more of an art house romantic drama. It's got Ben Mendelsohn in it. It's got an interesting cast. And that's kind of why I wanted to see it. And it was just offbeat enough that I thought you might actually like it.
Untogether is about four terrible people doing terrible things to one another. I didn't believe a word of it. Why is everybody just so damn sad? Jamie Dornan is so brooding and tortured, and he has no reason to be.
No, he does. And the reason comes out.
No, I don't think that's the initial reason. Even before, I won't get to that, but he lives in this minimalist Christian Grey style. He's as brooding as Christian Grey. It's ridiculous.
And not as clean-shaven.
the main couple is not Jamie Dornan and Jemima Kirk. It's Lola Kirk and Ben Mendelsohn are actually kind of the main. They look to be about a 20-year age difference mm-hmm. between the two. And I do not know what's going on with Lola Kirk as Tara in this film. She's falling in love with Billy Crystal, the rabbi. She's discovering her Jewish side. She's never been to temple or synagogue before, and she starts to go. And it kind of starts to affect her love for her, I guess, longtime live-in boyfriend. And there's a scene where she pees herself, which I really don't understand. There's a scene where she gives Billy Crystal a facial and then eats the cucumbers afterwards, which I don't understand.
Yeah, no, I agree. There were some.
It's not really art for art's sake. It's just art for confusion.
There were some moments that I didn't particularly care for, and it's definitely R rated. This is one that deserves its R rating.
This was more R than 50 Shades.
I
saw more here than I did in 50 Shades.
I wouldn't go that far.
Especially Jemima Kirk, who I don't think was fully clothed the whole film.
That's true. Well, no, she was in undergarments for a big portion of the film.
Weird undergarments.
Yeah, it was, I think,
like
it
the non-standard
was supposed to be
ones.
Her style. And the Billy Crystal role was a little weird, too, that playing this sort of charismatic rabbi who's on this social justice crusade and trying to, it sort of draws her in, excuse me, to that world and encourages her to come to temple more. And so she's essentially embracing her Jewish roots and the culture, and so she's changing. And in the meantime, the Ben Mendelsohn character, the boyfriend, he's kind of changing, but I couldn't figure out whether we were supposed to feel sympathetic towards him. He kind of came off as this sort of cross between like a Harrison Ford kind of look and Simon Cowell. If you kind of mash those two up, that's what Ben Mendelsohn looked like in this thing. He was sort of this aging, used to be a rocker, and he's trying to get back into his music biz. And the girlfriend suddenly kind of isn't there for him anymore. But the other real reason I thought you might like this is, I swear, I thought the best supporting role should go to the cat.
The cat Perry does undergo a change. There's no character in here to root for. There's no one to back.
That's true.
There's no one's likable. And there's plenty of films I've hated the entire cast and loved. Because sometimes you're just not supposed to like the characters and they're just not nice people. I would never want to hang out or have dinner or even coffee with any of these four just terrible people.
It's funny you should say that, because I actually did make a note that I don't particularly like any of the characters, but I don't hate them either.
Why are they so brooding? What's the point? What are they doing?
Because it's a romantic drama and they're all
struggling. It's not romantic. There's no romance in this
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, I don't know about the romance. It's a little strained.
No one is going to see this film, but B should see this film. It's ridiculous.
But I like that it's the actual, the sisters are real sisters in real life too. So,
I recognize Lola Kirk right off the bat. She was in Greta Gerwig's Mistress America.
Yeah, and this is just, to me, this is one of those indie vibe, smaller you know, romantic dramedies.
This is one that would eke in to Sundance.
And even, it would. And then Jennifer Grey, her character, I don't know what the heck was.
Jennifer Grey doing?
Yeah,
here?
I don't know what she was doing.
She has nothing to do.
She had nothing to do. She plays the rabbi's wife. And Scott Kahn from Hawaii Five-0, he's in there for like a minute.
He's got a whole 30 seconds.
I don't know quite what his role was supposed to be. But, and then it is funny that there are a few scenes that you can't help but see shades of Christian Grey.
Yeah.
It is.
He's got no reason to be as this torture. He hasn't earned this tortured soul that he is spouting.
Yeah, and he is a big part of the reason that that I sort of was interested in watching this film to see how it was. Because I did really like him in Private Life, the one that was about Marie Colvin, the
Private War.
So he was just recently in Private War, and that was based on the true story of Marie Colvin, a reporter who was killed. And he was very good in that. And he's been pretty good in a lot of these things. And there, I just find him kind of watchable. But he's just one that you're going to feel. You feel some empathy for. You feel some empathy for all four of these main characters a little bit.
I felt nothing for Andrea. Nothing. Jemima Kirk character. Nothing.
It was, it's hard to root for them, but.
When she got punched by a crackhead at the bus stop, I was like, good. Keep punching her, crackhead.
But that's interesting because I didn't love it. And I thought, well, maybe this is more one of those arty skewing films that that you would have found some redemptive value in, where I might have missed a few things.
No, you obviously liked this more than I did.
I didn't. I mean, I obviously liked it more than you did, but I didn't love it, and I certainly I can see why it really couldn't be released wide in theaters.
Huh.
And Billy Crystal is a very strange role for Billy Crystal to be in. And so you don't really know exactly what was going on. But hey, it was only 98 minutes, so I thought, you know, that's something too.
It only felt like 118.
And I did want to point out one other movie that I did catch up on this week. So while I did not see Miss Bala, I did stay home and watch The Ballad of Buster Scruggs finally.
You're only about 4 months late on
I'm paying off, you know, half my bet that I or challenge that I would see that before the Oscars. And that's one that I can guarantee you liked way.
I told you it's my third. It is the third
way
best film of the year of 2018.
I just can't. I can't put it up there. It's strange stuff, and it's Western satire, and it's mocking the whole genre. And
I don't think it's mocking it at all. I think it's celebrating it.
I don't know, but Coen Brothers are just an acquired taste, and you have the taste for the Coen Brothers stuff. I really just don't, and so I can absolutely. I mean, the cast is phenomenal. Luckily, the stories are short enough that if you're not really liking one, it's going to end soon enough, and you move on to the next. But series. I enjoyed the first one because it was just so freaking quirky, and you're like, what the heck is going on with this movie? But by the fourth, it was just getting a little old to me, and it just felt a little too long. But no, you know, without a doubt, they get some really good – the Coen brothers secure some really good actors for these roles, but it's just – and it's well shot, and – it's total quirk. The song is entertaining enough, When a Cowboy Trades His Spurs for Wings. So I'm glad that I've seen this now so that when they do potentially have that song played at the Oscars, I will know what it's in reference to. But I certainly would not choose that song over Shallow or probably any of the other nominees for Best Original Song. But again, you know, I'm glad you enjoyed it, but mocking the singing cowboy thing, and lots
not
of people
mocking. Not mocking.
Celebrating the death of singing cowboys everywhere. it's satire.
We seriously disagree on this film.
But at least I've seen it.
Just on opposite ends of the spectrum. I can't believe we saw the same film. All right. Did you do Agree or disagree this week?
I tried to just come up with a couple. We'll see if we've both got the same ones going.
I had a hunch what your big one would be, so I stayed away from that one. Mm-hmm. Mine are still about the Oscars a little mm-hmm. bit. Well, one is, but you want to bat lead off on this?
Well, my big one was definitely that the Oscar producers have backpedaled under pressure to feature performances of all five of the original songs. But I hear that their intent is to limit each performance to 90 seconds. And that's ridiculous because, first of all, you can't cut Shallow or any of these songs down to 90 seconds and really give it its full due and impact. So, personally, I disagree with that idea. I agree with them sort of relenting and doing all the five original songs, but I totally disagree with limiting performances to 90 seconds. How about you?
I have both an agree and disagree in that. I apparently Lady Gaga stepped in and said, hey, it's ridiculous that you're only going to feature two of the nominees. They were going to do all the stars from Black Panther and the Shallow from A Star Is Born. They were going to be their full and complete songs, and the other three were not going to be played. Lady Gaga said that it's not fair, and she used her smash, she used her clout, and the Oscar producers backed down and said, okay, we will now have all five nominees, but limited to 90 seconds, so it will be under 8 minutes long total. If you had all the songs in full, it would be over 17 minutes of 17 minutes of song. So I agree that all five should, if anyone will play, all five should play. That's where I agree. I disagree that any of them should play. I don't think any of the songs should be played at all. It should be treated like any other category. Okay, they want to save space this year. They've already booted off Best Cinematography into a commercial break.
I agree that part of it, too, is terrible.
So do not, I would say, have no songs played. Treat it like another category. That way you don't have to boot off Best Cinematography.
Yeah, I don't
understand.
To
fit in I'll Fight from RBG.
Oh, but that's a good song. And so I don't understand why they're making some of these choices that they are and whether they're going to try and cram this into 2 hours or 3 hours. I'm sorry. There is a way to make a very solid 2.5 to 3 hour Oscar telecast that has all five songs in their entirety, that has Best Cinematography and all that. You know, cut down on the really stupid banter, cut down on the gags. There is a way to make it happen. So I'm glad that the producers have, you know, realized that the backlash over not doing the songs was going to hurt them. But I think they still need to figure something out. You can't just say that all these songs can be done in a 90-second version. So we'll see what they come up with.
All right, my first one. Another hour, another Oscar rumor. Rumor has it, the band Queen was offered to open the show. No thanks.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
There is no host this year. It was going to be Kevin Hart. He backed out after Scandal. Now there's no host. So they said, Queen, you've been in the news this year with Bohemian Rhapsody. Why don't you pick a tune and open the show?
And they said no?
No. They've neither said yes nor no.
Oh, so I can agree that
rumor
that would
has
actually
it,
be...
They have been offered the slot where it would be, where you'd have Billy Crystal with his opening jokes.
Uh-huh.
Instead, you will have Queen playing.
It's an interesting choice.
No thanks.
I think you'd get some energy in the room going, and it, you know, Bohemian Rhapsody has gotten a lot of buzz. I mean, Rami Malek is still, I mean, he won the SAG Award last week. He's still the leading, sort of like that new potential front runner for a lead actor. So, you know.
Agree or disagree, Hannah?
I actually think I'd be okay with that. I think I agree that...
this ain't the Grammys.
I know, but that's why I love the music.
You can't find time for more than 90 seconds, but you're going to give Queen Fat Bottom Girls?
No, but hopefully that's not the one they would choose. I mean, hopefully they would come out and do like a quick medley, like a Live Aid style
medley.
Pretty
sure I saw a Live Aid remake already this year.
I know, but then... you know, considering, I mean, actually, when you think about the fact that you've got these five original songs, then celebrating these older songs that are in this you know, well-received biopic, I can actually think that that could work.
What a waste of time.
I don't know. I think having it start with some energy would be a nice change of pace.
Meh.
So, and speaking of awards, so the SAG Awards, Black Panther was the big winner, but the category is slightly different. You know, it's best, you know, best cast.
But at the SAG Awards, that is code for Best Picture.
It is code for Best Picture. Do you agree or disagree that that will translate into a potential Best Picture win at the Oscars?
It's certainly possible. I mean, there's automatic ones that it won't be. It won't be Vice. It won't be A Star Is Born. It's with the winning Best Ensemble at the SAG Awards, it's now in the top three, probably with Green Book, probably with Bohemian Rhapsody, maybe with Black Klansman circling around if people split the vote. But yeah, man, it got helped a lot this past week. Black Panther really hasn't won anything, a major award all year, until Best Ensemble at the SAG Awards. And that's a big win, big win. Yeah, I would raise an eyebrow, but I wouldn't be shocked if it won Best Picture. That's an arbiter.
I agree. Did you have any more?
I have one more.
Go for it.
Bohemian Rhapsody made a whole bunch of money. Now, we have green lights for a David Bowie biopic set in 1971 starring Johnny Flynn, and a Celine Dion biopic.
Oh my goodness.
Throttle back, Hollywood.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, Celine Dion, way too early, too soon.
And it's going to be in English and not French.
No. Too soon. Not good. Yeah, no. That's, no.
That's easy enough.
That's easy. That's easy enough. I would just give you agree or disagree. Best surprise from SAG, Emily Blunt for Best Supporting Actress for Quiet Place.
Yeah, I think you're right. Emily Blunt had two possible nominations for the Oscars. She got neither. She had, but she won a SAG Award for a role she wasn't even nominated for an Oscar. So yeah, that was a big shock. It was an awesome shock. It was,
yep.
You know, I had my personal favorites in the category, which I think is Rachel Weisz for the favorite. But I was more than happy to see Emily Blunt, because she was one of my top five supporting actresses for the year for that, for Giving Birth in the Bathtub. I think it was great. She declined the opportunity to sing her song, nominated for Best Song. The Oscar says it will be a surprise singer.
See, now I wasn't sure. Did she decline?
She did. Emily Blunt will not sing The Places Where Lost Things Go for 90 seconds. The Oscar says it will be a surprise singer, and people
could it be
already
Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Well, people at first people said, "Okay, Julie Andrews." All right, and then people were poking holes in that. Probably not Julie Andrews. Then someone was like, "Ooh, it's got to be Beyonce or Celine Dion." And so yeah, everyone's take Vegas bets now on who's it going to be.
See, I kind of that's one where I think it should be Emily Blunt, and I think considering all the uproar, that it's sort of unfair to the category then at that point. If the person who sang it in the film is not game to sing it.
They offered it to her. She said no.
No, but I'm saying I don't think she should have said no. I think given the...
Well, she's probably is pissed.
The backlash.
She didn't get her nominations, so why put herself through it?
I don't know. I still think people would have been very happy to see her.
Naturally. And she probably would have knocked it out of the park.
John Krasinski show up. Yes, I think she would. So,
but no.
I was hoping that it was going to be some surprise where it would just be her and Lin-Manuel Miranda would somehow both figure out a way to perform together.
It'd be Dick Van Dyke.
Now that you know what?
No, it won't be.
It might not be, but I would not be surprised at all if some big surprise was that he came shuffling across the stage.
No, I will not be shocked when a presenting pair is Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke. That won't shock me in the least. In fact, I halfway expect it. And now presenting for Best Live Action Short, Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke. Wouldn't shock me in the least.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, so that's my agree or disagree for this week. Did you have another one, or
no,
are you done?
No, I'm done. That's it. I'm apologizing on behalf of the films this week, because Miss Bala is a remake of just garbage.
Yeah, no, and therefore I will not bother to go see it. And Ballad of Buster Scruggs. Hey, if you haven't seen it yet, it's easy enough to go see.
Well, I'm saying the new releases. Velvet Buzzsaw is the best film of the week by far.
I mean, it's, I don't know.
By far.
It's just not going to appeal.
It has things to say.
It has things to say, but it's not going to say them to a lot of people. I don't think it's just going to really capture a wide audience. I still think, Miss Bella might still draw a certain, it's Gina Rodriguez's action hero. I mean, just for that, it might draw some crowd, and I think it's going to be a little more, I think it'll be a little more well-received in the end by the audience, more so than critics.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think it's going to make very much money.
Really, with 30% of Rotten Tomatoes, I don't have very high hopes, but you just never know when there's really very little else out there this week.
And Untogether can probably remain unspoken.
If you're a huge Jamie Dornan fan, then that's pretty much
that's
the
for
only...
all the huge Jamie Dornan fans out there.
Hey, you never know.
All right. Well, thank you very much for listening to our episode. Thank you. On behalf of the Cine Clash, I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.